Father's Day is coming up, and I wanted to offer something useful to dads who are tired of living a divided life. So I'm hosting a live workshop called Become a Better Leader by Becoming a Better Dad. Here's the core idea. We are not two different men, not a work self and a home self. We are one engine. And when there's a crack in how we lead at home, impatience, disconnection, reactivity, it shows up at work too, just in a different form. Because the real issue isn't our behavior. It's the patterns we fall back on when we don't have anything left. I call that version of us default dad. He's the one who shows up when we're tired, overloaded, or distracted. And while that pattern is easiest to spot at home, it affects our leadership everywhere. This workshop is a practical playbook to help you catch default dad earlier, lead with more intention under pressure, and become a calmer father and stronger leader. It's free. Consider it my Father's Day gift to dads. The link to register is in the show notes below, or visit ambitiousdads.com. Welcome, everyone, to the Ambitious Dads podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Hittner. After more than 200 conversations with fathers, I realized we are just not talking enough, not about our fears or our ambitions or how our kids are really doing or how we're holding up in the middle of all of it. This podcast is for the dads trying to build something meaningful and be present at home, the ones carrying a lot, questioning if they're doing enough, and craving honest conversations without the filters. If that's you, you're not alone. You are in the right place. Let's figure this out together. So I have a wonderful guest with me today, Dr. Kelly Flanagan. And I assume I can call you Kelly. Is that okay?
Please call me Kelly. Yes.
Awesome. Well, so just a quick bio on Kelly. So he is an author, a speaker, a coach, a clinical psychologist, and a definitive thought leader on interpersonal relationships. So something I know we all need a little bit of support in, right? Mm-hmm. So, and Kelly, I know you've got some work, a book coming out in the future as well. We'll spend a little bit of time talking about that. But I really wanted to kick us off on the fact that you are also a father of three. And it sounds like you are at the later stages, right? You have, I imagine, one that's flown the coop, and then, yeah, well, you can just fill
that's,
it.
That's what I thought. Although, you know, so we have a 22-year-old son who's living in Chicago, working full-time at Trader Joe's to pay his own bills, and then chasing his dream of becoming a comedian on nights and evenings. Yeah.
Wow.
And though I said to my wife recently, I was like, out of our three kids, which one have we spent the most sort of emotional energy on in the last, you know, quarter? And she's like, Aiden, the 22-year-old. So this whole idea, I guess, that they're you know, grown and flown is starting to fade away for me. And I feel blessed by that we're still involved in his life and that he is still connected with us in that way. But I don't know. The challenges don't get easier. I don't think they just change. You know, you're always a parent. So yeah, he's 22. And then we have an 18-year-old about to graduate high school, son Quinn. And then my daughter Caitlin is 16, just got her driver's license. And we have a couple more years left with her at home before she takes off.
It's already interesting how you frame that question, like, which one do we spend the most emotional energy on? Because I think about that as well. You know, I have two boys, a 5 and an 8-year-old. And for sure, there is much more emotional energy spent on the 5-year-old. And it's not just because he's 5.
Yeah.
So it's how do you weigh that in terms of how you engage with all three children, like when they're all in the house at the same time? Or how do you think about, you know, giving your time to your kids when one takes a lot more emotional energy?
Boy, that's a good question. This is such a new frontier for us. I haven't really thought about that. So I'll sort of think out loud. I think because we have so much less time with Aiden now that and he's pretty independent, so that when he does sort of step back on stage in our life, there's this like sense of like, we want to give our full attention to him, right? Whether it's a phone call or he's home for Thanksgiving or he didn't go to college, so we don't get any of that like month at Christmas. So if he's home, mm-hmm. like it's like you get 3 days and then he's back to work. And so, and yet the other two kids don't cease to exist in those spaces, you know, and we're keenly aware right now that our 18-year-old, now having gone through this with Aiden, we're keenly aware that our 18-year-old is also about to fly the coop and that our time with him is about to get cut dramatically. And so you don't want to miss any of that. And then I guess now that I'm saying it out loud, I worry about poor Caitlin. she's also sort of the quietest and she sort of fills in the gaps like the youngest often does, you know? So maybe I'm talking myself into an awareness that we need to make sure she's getting her fair share of attention as well. But for me, the growth in recent years has been that is, these three people are, in our life, so briefly in a sense that, there were many years in which I was not tuned into that and I missed out on a lot. And so I want to have at least three priorities before my work, you know, three kids. And I hope that's true for the rest of my days, actually, that as they like Aiden, you know, now that he's gone, I still want him to be a priority over and above my work. So, that is something that's come into clear focus as the time with them has dwindled.
And I imagine you work from home, correct?
I do work from home now. Yeah, I used to own and operate a mental health practice with several therapists, but I closed that, and now I write and I coach from home. So I'm in this space all the time.
And can you tell me a little bit in terms of your story? You talk a lot about a turning point where things were difficult in your life. Your marriage was falling apart. Mm. I think a lot of dads, if their marriages haven't completely fallen apart, have gotten to the cusp of it, especially yes. raising multiple children. And just kind of what was your experience like? Because it's always nice to hear it from a guy.
Yeah.
And what helped you get through it?
You know, I think if I had to pick, you know, there's multiple points of punctuation in any relationship where there's significant breakthroughs and pivots. And we've had a number of those in our marriage. I mean, if you want to talk about the potentially the most precarious moment for our marriage, my wife and I, her name is also Kelly. She's also Dr. Kelly. We were doing our clinical residencies at the same time, just married with a newborn. And it was about and no money. It was about as stressful as life gets. And, you know, she's a fiery Portuguese woman. And one day I got her so angry, she slammed the bedroom door in our apartment and like literally cracked the frame out of the plaster wall. I mean, like that to me stands out as like, we were sort of on the edge of not lasting. And there've been moments here, you know, here and there since then where things really became a struggle. Most recently for me, it was COVID. You know, we were both, in the position of suddenly overnight having to do something that was illegal yesterday, which was to run a therapy practice where you saw clients remotely. That was illegal in the healthcare industry prior to COVID. And now overnight, we're trying to transition both of our mental health practices to that model. And there's no infrastructure for it. Like Zoom, of course, existed and it took off during that time, but it didn't have a HIPAA compliant version of it. So you couldn't do therapy over Zoom. So how are you going to execute on this? Super stressful. The kids were like, I called them zombies at home, you know, it was homeschooling. It was not going well. I was getting triggered over and over again during COVID and not showing up the way I wanted to as a dad. And I couldn't seem to do anything about it. One afternoon, my wife convinced me to finally get the above ground pool in the backyard because all the public pools were closing. And so we got it. One afternoon, she threw the hose over the side of it to fill it up for the first time and put a rock on the hose, but the rock wasn't heavy enough. And we left it for like 3 or 4 hours. And so we come out 3 or 4 hours later and the backyard is like a lake and there's no water. And I just like lost my mind. And I was like, I got to go away. Like this is, I can't keep showing up like this. So I get on my bike to blow off steam. And like 5 minutes into just a really incautious ride, I almost get hit by a car. I go over the handlebars. I break my collarbone in two places. It doesn't heal properly. And so like the rest of that first year of COVID for me was a painful, long recovery. And I got to New Year's Eve going into 2021, and I was out of shape, and I was literally looking, you know, scrolling the internet. This is pre-AI, so I still scrolled the internet, right? And I was looking for, you know, keto versus paleo, circuit training versus strength training, all these sorts of things. And at the same time, I'm listening to a book by Michael Singer called The Untethered Soul.
I know that book.
You know that book. Yeah. Like, it's a powerful book. And he says in it, do not let anything in life be important enough that you're willing to close your heart over it. And in that moment, it hit me that most of what I'd been suffering throughout COVID was not because of COVID. It wasn't because of school closings. It wasn't because of the challenges of transitioning there. It wasn't because we got water in our backyard. It was because my heart was closing immediately to all these experiences. I was resisting experiencing them. So I set a New Year's resolution going into 2021. Moment to moment, I will notice my heart closing and try to open it back up. And here we are almost 5 years later, and it remains my core sort of relational spiritual practice day to day. Is moment to moment, I will notice my heart closing and try to open it back up. And I've already gotten to practice it several times this morning. So it's a daily moment to moment practice, but it has transformed my life in the last 5 years. It's transformed my relationship to my wife, my relationship to my kids. It's transformed my business. It's transformed the way I show up to life in general. So that's been one of the most significant pivots in the way I show up as a father and a husband.
That's beautiful. Can you give an example of what it means or feels like for your heart to be closing, and then what you do to open it back up?
Yeah. Well, just yesterday morning, the most recent one that stands out was I'm sitting here just about to start appointments for the day, and I get an email from my son's top college choice. And we're like 3 days away from early action deadline. And it says your application is incomplete. Well, it's mid morning. I can hear him stomping around upstairs because he's got a break in classes his senior year, and he comes home and changes. So I feel my heart close. And that closing, the earliest warning sign that your heart is closing is your nervous system activating, and that can always be felt somewhere between your waist and your temples. Okay, no one ever said my heart closed and I felt my toes cramp. It's like that. It's that tightening in the gut, the tension in the chest, in the jaw, shoulders, neck, somewhere between waist and temple. So I could feel it in my chest. I could just feel that sort of tightening. And I could feel what I wanted to do. And I got up, I climbed the stairs to go find him, and I could feel what I wanted to do. I wanted to take control of the situation. I wanted to demand things from him. I wanted to question his integrity. Well, why isn't this done? And I knew that if I showed up with that kind of closed heart, the conversation would go south. And so I stopped at the top of the stairs. Thankfully, he was in his bathroom. That might have saved me. Gave me like just an extra moment of pause to go, okay, like breathe, get your nervous system regulated. That's the first thing. Because if your nervous system's dysregulated, it's telling your heart and your mind that you are not safe. You'll never be able to open your heart if your nervous system thinks you're not safe. So get your nervous, you're safe, look around. Everything's okay. Okay, now you're calm. Open your heart. One of the first things, and I get emotional thinking about this, is as soon as I opened my heart, I just had this full image of who my son is. Mm-hmm. And I instantly knew he'll get the application in on time. I know who he is, right? Mm-hmm. So I go to his bedroom door, I call into his bathroom. Hey, dude, I got an email that your application is incomplete. He's like, I got it too, on it, no worries. I'm like, yeah. That's the truth, right? Years ago, 5-6 years ago, man, think about the things I would have said and the messages I would have communicated to him about who I think he is when it's not even true. Like, I believe in him, but when my heart is closed, I think I have to control everything. And so that was just a subtle moment yesterday in the middle of the morning. The whole thing lasted a minute and a half, 2 minutes. But because of that 2 minutes, you know, the 2 days and the 2 weeks that would have spiraled out from that closed heart didn't happen. So powerful pivot.
Wow. You know, do you notice when your heart, by the way, your son gave the perfect teenager response.
Yes.
Do you notice when you wake up in the morning, like if it's open or closed as well? Because I definitely to wake up in the morning now and distinctly yes. feel like there's something heavy here in my chest. Yes.
That's a great way to describe it.
My experience, so I'm curious to get your thoughts. My experience is then I go, I think I need to cry. Because when I wake up heavy, to me, that saying there's like a sadness weighing on me. And so I might put on, like, I have, you know, just a couple of go-to songs that if they don't bring the tears, then I've got like a letter from a family member that 100% brings the tears. And it doesn't, I mean, it sort of seems forced, but somehow maybe it's the same thing. Maybe it's open. It opens me up for the rest of the day, or at the very least, it lightens me up for the rest of the day. And yeah,
that is a powerful insight, man. One of the main things I've learned over the last 5 years, because I went to Singer's book and was like, okay, well, how do I keep my heart open all the time? And he's great, but he just says, like, you just relax and release. And I'm like,
it's so easy.
It's almost like he's like sort of a math savant, you know, and it comes so easy to him. He can't explain rudimentary math to the rest of us. So it doesn't work for me. So I've had to sort of figure out, like, what's the process for doing this? I would say that a lot of times when we think we're closing our heart because we are reacting to something going on out there, what we're actually doing is closing our heart so we don't feel something in here.
Yes.
Right. And so the wisdom of recognizing that my heart's closed, it might not be closed to my day. It might be closed because a part of me doesn't want to start my day with sadness. If I can open my heart to that sadness and let it flow as sadness is designed to do, then my heart is automatically open. I often say that the two main things that open your heart from the inside out are sadness or joy. And we don't have any trouble letting joy open our heart, right? That's fun.
Culturally, sadness is a tough one, right?
Culturally, we are told that sadness is wrong, when in fact, sadness is just one of the two experiences that's trying to open your heart. And once your heart's open, all of a sudden you're at peace. One of the things I often say is that sadness is really the main form of emotional pain, and that the other two that we often group in with it, anxiety and anger, are not forms of emotional pain, but forms of resisting emotional pain. So your sadness usually starts in your gut as a heaviness, or a pressure or a fullness. And sadness is a really buoyant emotion. Like, it's designed to flow up through your body and then exit your body through your eyes. I was given a talk recently to a room full of families, all ages. And I said, hey, how does sadness like to exit the body? And the adults looked at me like I was crazy. And the kids are all like, oh, through the eyes. I'm like, yeah, you still know. and so that's what sadness is trying to do. When it gets up to about our chest and we block it, with our psyche, with our body itself, the tension of that upward moving sadness and the closed heart pushing down creates that tension that you feel as anxiety. And then if that sadness gets up past the chest and we still don't want it to come out as sadness, you know, we'll turn it into anger at the last minute and it comes out our mouth, as anger. So, a big part of the practice for me with open heartedness is, yeah, just learning to let sadness come through when it's needing to. And then learning that never lasts more than about 90 seconds, like any other emotion. If you just let it flow through, and then you get to go on with your day. Dude. Powerful insight. Thank you for naming it.
No, thank you. And it's so interesting because yesterday my son, he gets like a shot every month for this allergy that he has. And we're at the doctor's office and it's an old doctor, and he comes in and he's like, all right, you ready to be a man today and no tears? And I immediately turned to my son and said, Riv, don't worry. In our family, big men cry. And he goes, I know, Daddy. And the doctor goes, well, yeah, I mean, I guess I cry when Real Madrid loses. And I was like, oh, okay.
Real men are allowed to care about sports enough.
Yeah, like, but that's what we're up against.
That's what we're up against.
You know, culturally, but also we have a responsibility in our families to let our children know that, like, when we say certain emotions are bad, what we're doing is we're not preventing those emotions. We're just sort of like redirecting that energy so they know I'm not allowed to express this, which is a horrible way to develop our kids' emotional intelligence. And yeah, you just see how much is around us all the
time. That's right. And young children, when they arrive in the world naturally, they don't seem to differentiate between happiness as positive and sadness as negative. They feel sadness as freely as they feel happiness. And it just
they can cry on a dime
or dime.
Give them a dessert or you yeah. name it. Right. So, yeah.
And and I think the response can be, let it out. You know, one of the more powerful moments I remember with my son is he walked out of a sports practice, unusually emotional a number of years ago, and he got in the car and he just couldn't keep it in, and it just sort of overflowed and came out. And I just remember saying to him, yeah, man, let it out. Like I bottled that in and had to tell a therapist when I was 35, like, let it out now. You don't need to carry that around for another 20 years, you know? And that's sort of I think that sounds like our families have a similar ethos around that, which is, if you feel something, let it come through. That's what you're meant to do. Yeah.
Yeah. There are still inappropriate ways to like share certain feelings. Like there's inappropriate ways to show anger and inappropriate ways to show fear and all those things. But what we're not saying is you don't have them and you don't have a productive way to release them. And yes. I think because I'm mentioning that because I think several fathers have asked me that question. Well, like, I can't just cry at the office or something like that. And I'm like, well, you know, there's plenty of high level executive women who do just that because like they know that's how they're going to perform better afterwards. And we need to start doing that, too.
And that's, I think, exactly like the bad name that feeling sadness has gotten is not because of sadness, but because of our resistance to it. Like when you're at the office and you're feeling sadness and you're resisting feeling it, it lasts all day because it just get to flow through the way you want it to. Yeah. If you can truly just let that pass through the way it wants to, it will not last longer than 90 seconds. And now you're open, you're connected with your full self, you're ready to show up with your deepest, wisest parts. This was a few months ago. I got to the dinner table after a long day. I had not really had any chance to check in with myself. And I'm sitting there and I realized that I couldn't really join in with the dinner table conversation because I had this heavy sadness inside of me. And I'm like, I don't know that, like my kids are already a little bit worried about my sanity, right? Like, I don't know if I want to like break down right here at the table. So I was like, I'm just going to talk about it. And I said, hey, does anybody ever just feel sad and you don't know why? And my daughter looks at me, you know, and she's at the time 15. She looks at me, she goes, why do you ask? And I said, well, because I'm feeling sad right now and I have no idea why. And she goes, oh, I thought it was because you could tell that I feel sad right now and I have no idea why. Right. And I was like, no, I didn't know that, but fist bump. I guess we both have some sadness here at the table. And that felt like enough for that moment, just to allow it to be named rather than felt fully. So I just think there's this, there's different degrees to which we can open to it.
Thank you for sharing that. Can you tell me a little bit more about how you work with your kids to be cognizant of their emotions and express their emotions and all of that? Because you said our families have possibly a similar goal there, but I think as a psychologist, I'd love to hear kind of if there's anything that you do in particular with your family. I mean, that dinner table example is perfect and very authentic.
That was an unusual moment with my daughter, because my daughter's main response when you ask her, like, what are you feeling right now? Or you looks is no therapy. I don't want a session. Right. And I think that it, like, I mean, gosh, two psychologists married, right? That's a trope, because I think a lot of times psychologists like to camp out in that role of therapist and be in that role everywhere they go. And, but as a job, as a parent, I think your job is to be responsive to your kids' personalities and to let them guide how much you get in there, right? Mm-hmm. Like as a therapist, someone is hiring you to come and join into their inner world. Your kids have not hired you to do that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the harder things about raising teenagers is that they increasingly keep you out of their inner world. And you have to, as a parent, learn how to deal with the sense of separation and loneliness that comes from that and the anxiety of control around not having influence. But anyhow, so I think for us, you know, the invitation to talk about what's going on in there is always there, but to think of it as an invitation, not a requirement, and to let the kids, I think they know that. And in our family with two therapists, like it's, you know, it's not a stretch. Like they know we're ready to talk about what's going on inside of us. Mom and I will talk about what's going on inside of us. You can listen to whatever extent you want to and tune out when you want to. So I think it's just that, that willingness to say that the interior world is really important and there's space here to explore it if you want to. But we're not going to force you to.
I love that. And do they do it less and less as they become teenagers and young adults?
Good question. I wouldn't say so. All I have to report on right now is our trajectory. And I don't know if it's related to each of their distinct personalities. I'd say Aiden's definitely opened up more now that he's away. For him, at least, like trying to establish a sense of separateness and independence and freedom almost from the womb, but certainly more in his teenage years, meant that he wasn't going to be inviting us into a whole lot of what was going on inside of that. Was one of his ways of establishing independence. But now that he's got his actual independence, like he's financially independent, yeah. Like now, like there's more space to have those internal conversations. I think we feel more connected with Aiden than we ever have. Quinn has always just had a clever way of letting us in when he wants to and not letting us in when he doesn't. And that's stayed pretty steady, I think. He's on the verge of leaving. I'd say there've been punctuated moments where he let us in on something that he was ashamed of or wasn't sure how we would react, and our acceptance of that thing has then led to greater openness on the other side of it. But frankly, those are some of the harder moments we've had with him, right? That openness seems to grow more through the hard moments than the fun moments. And then Caitlin is just she's so interesting. She's still riding to school with her brother because we only have one car for them. And she was in the car and I could hear him chattering away at her. And I just see her, she looks at me through the window and she mouths, "Help." which is like just her way of communicating what's going on in there. She just got this sort of clever, subtle way of doing it. So I don't know, but my sense is probably as they establish themselves out in the world, if you've kept an open line of communication up to that point, they'll feel even more freedom to connect once they've got independence in other ways.
It's a nice thought to have, as several of the dads that I've worked with have talked about this fear of what happens when they start to pull away and will it come back?
Will it come back? Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You brought up a really important word, ashamed or shame. And it's a big piece of fatherhood right now. I often quote the statistic that 92% of dads primarily identify as fathers, like it's their primary core identity, and yet only about a third of them think they're doing a good job. And so we have this big confidence gap, and it gets filled pretty quickly with shame. Shame that they're like not doing the right thing when their kid gets upset, or they're not punishing correctly, or they're not communicating well, or this isn't working. And it becomes a pretty vicious cycle. What's your experience in terms of shame and fatherhood, and how do you kind of see that evolving? I I imagine I'm giving you a softball to sort of connect it to your work on triggers as well.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, the first thing I'd say is like, you know, kids don't need perfect parents. They need parents who know they're not perfect. Right.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, Aiden was almost launched when I finally kind of came to my awareness around triggers and open-heartedness. He got the brunt of my closed-heartedness. Right. And so my, I feel like my job as a parent is not to beat myself up for that, but to grow so that I'm ready to be open-hearted when he comes to me and says, "Hey, this is the wound you left me with. This is the legacy that you've left me with." For me to go, "Oh, yes, yes, I see that." And to be really ready to connect about that. So I think that's an encouragement I'd give to dads, is don't worry about being perfect. Deal with the shame so you feel like you don't have to defend your imperfections. The other thing I'd say is I love what you're doing, man, because we're the first generation of dads who felt the calling, I guess I'd call it, to be engaged with our kids at this level, to be whole human beings who are showing up not just as providers, but also present and emotionally available. I mean, we have no models for this, not too many at least. And so here we are going, and I think a big part of this is that we are amongst the first generation of people to take their past really seriously and to go, "My past is influencing my present. I'm aware of this. It's knitted into my nervous system." That's part of where the triggers come from, right? And so I know my past affects me. And so now I'm looking at my past and oh man, these are the things I wish I'd received from my father, right? These are the deficits I felt in those relationships. And now I want to not replicate that with my kids, but I got no guides. I got no models for that. I got no experience with it. So now I'm sort of making it up on my own and trying to figure out how to do that. No wonder it's hard. I mean, in a way, like, I hope dads listening who go, "I don't know how to do this," and go, "Yeah, that's the honest, authentic, you don't need to be ashamed of that. That's the truth. It takes courage to admit that. But stay committed to the learning process. And I think a big part of that is communities of men like you're creating with this podcast who can say to someone else, "I don't know what I'm doing," or I don't feel confident in what I'm doing. And this is the thing about shame. It diminishes in the light. It's like, try it. Feel it, something you feel ashamed of, something you feel not good enough at. Go tell somebody, "I don't feel good enough at this," and you'll immediately feel yourself less ashamed of it. And so communities of men who are sort of acknowledging that is a powerful tool as well. So I love what you're doing here.
Thank you so much. And you know, actually in the most recent program I ran, 2/3 of the fathers in that program hadn't even heard the word triggers before. So can we talk a little bit more about like what that means in a more generic context? And then what is your focus on that topic in general?
Mm. Yeah. So, triggered is an interesting word right now. Because first of all, that word really didn't exist in its current context in the human lexicon until, you know, a little bit after post-World War II into Vietnam War era. We started to talk about combat veterans who were triggered into their traumatic experiences. You know, a car would backfire and suddenly they were back in Vietnam. And so at first the word triggered was associated with deeply, deeply wounded people with mental health disorders resulting from severe trauma. And now triggered has sort of been hijacked by TikTok, right? And like you'll have an influencer who gets the wrong kind of cold foam at Starbucks and they're like blasting out to everybody that they're triggered by it, right? And so it's sort of like, it's trite and trivial in that sense. And so the way I think about triggered is it's not something that's only happening to people who've been through severe forms of trauma. It's also not something that's happening every day, everywhere to everybody, right? It's something that's happening in very specific, repeated moments, usually in key relationships, Sometimes in the broader world, but oftentimes it happens most in our key relationships where we bring our needs and deficits and say, I want to feel better in here, and it's not happening. We end up starting to get triggered regularly. And when we get triggered, our nervous system is activating. It feels like we're in danger. Our heart is starting to close. And so we're flipping from connection mode into protection mode. Right. And then we attempt to continue to connect, even though we're in protection mode, and we put our people in the worst possible position. No, I'm trying to connect with you, but actually I'm completely defensive right now. Right. And those two things are mutually exclusive. Part of beginning to reverse that is to recognize that until you're back in connection mode, you have no business trying to connect. It will only create more rupture, which you will then have to repair. And that's what getting triggered does. It creates the cycle of rupture and repair. So we want to disrupt that by taking ownership of that triggered moment, learning how to take responsibility for getting yourself regulated and back in open-hearted connection mode, and then showing up to your people. So that's how I'm thinking of it these days.
It's beautiful. And in my family, you know, for instance, I talk a lot about how I used to always be triggered by my children's very long temper tantrums. And as I wasn't able to flip that overnight, what I got really good at was the second part, which was the repair. So when you do walk away, because you can't sit through the whole, you know, situation, because it's, again, it's just putting you in protective mode. But you do come back afterwards when your heart is open again. Like the first thing we like to do in our family, at least, is to repair. And I've noticed my oldest son is extremely skilled at this now. My 5-year-old will like lie to, I watched him hit his brother yesterday. I scolded him for it, and he, to my face, for 5 minutes screamed out that he didn't do it because he wasn't capable yet, or doesn't seem to be capable yet, of like owning that feeling of shame and also apologizing. But I wasn't also going to give in and let him
let him gaslight you.
Yeah. So I was like, no, you did hit him.
Yeah.
And he just kept, you know, screaming that he didn't for another 5 minutes until he moved on. And I just hope eventually he figures out that, because I tried to not change my voice so that he knows that it's not a big deal to make that mistake.
Yes.
And that he can own it eventually. Yes. Just to get there took years and years and years of
managing. Oh, yes. Yeah. What you did there was really powerful. Like, I think as men, we think that things that we do are powerful, but the way we are is powerful, right? Like, if he's going to ever learn how to own his mistakes, which currently already at age 4, you said?
5.
If age 5, he already, that feels dangerous to say, I made a mistake, right? And at some level, by the way, it's because there's a very primal thing going on where he believes if he's made a mistake, he deserves banishment from the tribe, and he'll be completely separate and on his own, and it terrifies. I mean, it's like, there's a reason he won't admit it. It's terrifying. It's existentially threatening to a 5-year-old. If I made a mistake, that could cost me the tribe. So, but what you did was you created a safe space. The only place someone can admit mistakes, the only place someone can open their own heart. The thing that most helps someone to regulate their nervous system is to be in a safe space. And so you provided that safe space. Once I said to Quinn's before he's driving, I was driving him somewhere and he was being really, and I was stuck with him because I was driving him. And I said to him, I go, bud, I love you unconditionally, but I don't drive you unconditionally. If you keep treating me like this, I'm going to have to let you out. But while you're walking, no, I really love you. And so I think like creating the safe space for the acting out while having boundaries, it's all part of the dance of that open-heartedness stuff.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. I know we have to go in a moment. Can you tell our audience what it is you're working on now? You're very, very passionate around a lot of these topics in your clinical work and
Well, for me, that shift into that New Year's resolution 5 years ago, this New Year's Eve, actually, of moment to moment, I'll try to notice my heart closing and open it back up. It changed my life. It changed my business. It changed the work that I do with clients. And so it has become sort of the core passion of what I do. So for the last 5 years, I've been working on a process that can be replicated by anybody to learn how to keep your heart open in those crucial moments. And so I've laid it out in a new book I've written called The Road Less Triggered. And it is, it's going to come out in March of 2026. I'm very excited about it. It is a pretty wild thing to be basically working on an idea for 5 years and to finally be on the verge of getting to share it with people. So, and over on Substack, you know, at the Less Triggered Tribe, we're talking about this stuff every day. I haven't even announced the book to them yet, but that's coming soon. So, we're just on the threshold of finally getting to share a lot of this stuff with people, and I'm really excited.
Awesome. Kelly, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure, and enjoy the day with your family.
Jeff, thank you so much. You as well.